Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Anil Dabari, the Director of Comprehensive Gastrointestinal Motility Center and a member of the Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at Children's National Hospital, is with us to share an overview of gastrointestinal motility and mitochondrial function. My name is Stephanie Harry, and I'm the Patient Support Coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families who are in this space today, but please put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not in the chat. It helps me to stay better organized when we kick off our Q&A time at the end of today's presentation. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. Today, Dr. Dabari will discuss a very important topic for our mito community. Gastroparesis and motility complications are not uncommon for those with mitochondrial disease. During this presentation, Dr. Dabari will provide a background of our current understanding of gastrointestinal motility and explore the complexities that patients face with diagnosis and current treatment strategies for conditions related to mitochondrial function. He will also explain current understanding surrounding neuropathy of the gut and explore unanswered and answered questions as to why this occurs. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Dabari. Dr. Dabari is the director of the Comprehensive Gastrointestinal Motility Center and a member of the Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at Children's National Hospital. He is also the professor of pediatrics at George Washington University of Medicine and Health Sciences. Dr. Dabari leads his team of pediatric GI motility experts, advanced practice providers, and other allied staff at Children's National Hospital. The goal of his team is to enhance the care of children living with complex GI problems related to the GI function and motility as a result of impaired function of the nerves and muscles of the GI tract. He's developed and led multidisciplinary programs, collaborating with several programs such as the colorectal and general surgery, cardiology, genetics, pulmonology, behavioral psychology, and pain medicine in the areas of GI motility disorders, disorders of gut-brain interaction, posterior orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS, cystic fibrosis, autism, genetic and metabolic disorders. Dr. Dabari has practiced for over 25 years in pediatric gastroenterology with a focus on conditions related to gastrointestinal motility and disorders of gut-brain interaction. He served as faculty at Johns Hopkins University, Kennedy Krieger Institute, and Children's National for over the past 3 decades. Dr. Dabari has provided leadership in many organizations, including the chair of Neurogastroenterology and GI Motility Committee of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition. Dr. Dabari, we value your work and the care that you bring to many of our patients in our community, and we're really excited for you to talk a little bit about gut motility. This is a theme that's brought up so often, whether it's through our MITO-401 calls, our support calls, and so we're just really appreciative for you taking the time and sharing with us your knowledge, your wisdom, and your research. So thank you so much for being here today.
All right. Thank you so much for the very kind and elaborate description. I'm really honored to be here. My interest lies in gut motility, but I do like to spread the word around and share what I have understood over the decades. So let me share my screen. And as we mentioned earlier, we're having a little bit of technical issues in that the Microsoft PowerPoint wasn't cooperating. And as soon as I go in the presentation mode, it's kicking us out. So we're going to go slide by slide. So please bear with me, as we say here at Children's National, since our logo is a bear. Here's my introductory slide, but I want you to be open with your questions. This is just a structure so that we have a presentation, a talk in the beginning, and then we can definitely discuss, as questions come up in your mind. So we'll talk a little bit about what is basics of gut motility, what it involves, why it's important, how it presents, especially in childhood, since I take care of children with it. How do we approach it for diagnostic evaluation, and then how we can manage it? One important thing to remember is that this is a non-CME talk, so it's kind of like a disclaimer. It's not meant to provide you full CME credits or continuing medical education credits. It's a talk for a discussion with some background of knowledge, and all the contents are mine. I have made all these up over time, as well as evidence has evolved in this field. They don't represent Children's National or any other organization that I represent. They are totally my views. And they don't constitute medical advice. So they are just basically discussion of, in general, how gut motility and its disorders work or don't work. And I get no compensation for this conversation. So those are my disclaimers. So when we start talking about gut motility, we have to remember our GI tract starts from the mouth, and it finishes at the very end where poop comes out, and that's where the end of the GI tract is. However, if you think of the composition of this long tract, it is basically a tube going from one end to the other, and the purpose of this is to sustain our bodies. So we have known for a long time at the systemic level, we knew this as vital for us to survive. We cannot live without our guts. I know several people these days are demonstrating that we can live without our brains, but if we don't have gut, we really cannot survive as human beings. So the gut is vital for us to survive. Because as the food that we intake goes down our esophagus to the organ level, we're talking about when it goes into the stomach, stomach holds it there, it kind of grinds it down, makes it smaller, and then passes it slowly into the small intestine, where the majority of digestion absorption, or almost all of digestion and absorption, happens, and then becomes waste, which is passed on to the large intestine, which is our waste processing or waste managing organ, and then it stores the solid waste at the end that we can desire and decide when to let it out. So that's how the things progress from top to bottom, or from proximal to distal at the organ level. Over years, people have studied this motility of movement of things at the tissue level and then at cellular level. And these days, we know a lot about at the subcellular levels, which is where conditions where mitochondria are involved become very interesting, because mitochondria, as I'm sure you or most of you have heard, are the powerhouses, the battery power to the organs to work. So the secret for gut motility is its neuromuscular supply, its electrical supply, and the movement of the gut is in the muscles of the intestines. So if we don't have energy, if we don't have the powerhouse supplying that energy, then it behooves us to understand that that would present with the problem of the motility of the GI tract. So when we look at the subcellular level in the cells, these cells are called smooth muscle cells or interstitial cells of Cajal. We see electrical activity going on at that level, which is very similar to the activity that the entire muscle at the organ level is happening, which is about 3 cycles per minute. So to me, this is a fascinating fact that was shown about 15, 20 years back, that the The origin of the muscular or neuromuscular activity in the organ level is very similar to what we see at the subcellular or cellular levels. And which then brings us to how these, when things don't go right, when things are not moving along as they should, how would they present? So, for simplicity's sake, we try to divide them into upper and lower or foregut and colorectal kind of motility problems, but these are artificial descriptions just for our conveniences. Typically, if you have a problem more with the upper gastrointestinal tract, you will start with having difficulty with swallowing or managing secretions or managing food as it goes down or feeling some pain or difficulty as it goes down in our chest. So dysphagia is basically difficulty swallowing, feeling in the chest, some discomfort, odynophagia, chest pain, etc. Or things start going backwards, which is gastroesophageal reflux. If things reach the stomach and they're not moving forward, typically most people will experience some nausea or distension and bloating, and sometimes will lead to vomiting. Another unrecognized or poorly recognized symptom could be early satiation. So we may start feeling full after taking a few bites, and that could be because things are not moving forward. So we kind of feel the effect of stasis or slow movement. The end result could be poor nutrition, which is kind of counterproductive because poor nutrition itself will lead to further poor motility. As things go in the small intestine, again, most of these symptoms will happen: distension, bloating, feeding intolerance. And further down in the GI tract, we will experience mostly constipation because things won't move and the poop is not coming out in time, or having some difficulty in getting it out towards the very end in the anorectal disc motility. So it's just helpful for us to think of these symptoms as a guide of what we experience when the gut motility doesn't work. Now, along with that, there is this overlay of symptomatic presentation. So I like this slide a lot to understand the GI symptoms because you may have poor motility where the stomach is not moving things along, and you experience some nausea, bloating, abdominal pain. But you may also have the opposite. You may have actually have diarrhea, say for example, in irritable bowel syndrome, which is what we call a functional condition or disorder of gut-brain interaction. And you may have diarrhea and constipation with IBS, and you may still experience abdominal pain and bloating. On the other hand, you may have upper GI tract conditions such as functional dyspepsia, where you feel full after eating a little bit. You may have a little bit more epigastric or higher up in the chest burning and discomfort, and that can present with similar symptoms. So the main purpose of this is to understand that there is a lot of overlap in the symptoms. So the functional bowel conditions, which imply that the function itself is normal, the motility itself is normal, could very well present with a gut motility condition. Or the presentation could look very similar whether you have a functional condition or you have a gut motility condition. So once we have decided that there's enough symptoms, we should look into poor motility. How do we look at it? So there's a whole bunch of tests you can do, but I always emphasize the most important is this history and physical examination. This is where you can talk about what we are experiencing, and we can examine our bodies and see what it is showing, what it's trying to tell us. And that, to me, is the most valuable test, because majority of the time when I'm talking to family members, and by the time I've examined the child, because my practice is in pediatrics, we would have a pretty good sense of what's going on. So the tests that we recommend are most likely going to be helpful in aiding the diagnosis. They're not meant to be the exclusive ways of diagnosing these things. So they're not randomly picked tests that because the test is available, we should do that. So there are a bunch of tests you can do. They are radiological tests, like X-ray studies, both like pictures, but also dynamic X-ray studies, endoscopic tests that are done with the use of cameras. And then we also measure the gut motility itself with these tests called manometry, or we measurement of pressure. So mano means pressure. So we can measure pressures in the esophagus, in the stomach, small bowel, colon, and the anorectal areas. And sometimes we use treatment as a test. So let's start from the top. An X-ray study called an upper GI study, where you drink a contrast and take an X-ray, is predominantly designed to look at the structure of our GI tract or gastrointestinal tract. So when you swallow, your esophagus fills up and it goes into the stomach. We can get a very good sense of if there's any narrowing or kink, etc. Or when from stomach it doesn't go out into the intestine, there's a narrow channel, this condition called pyloric stenosis. Or if all the intestines are on one side and not equally distributed both sides, condition called malrotation. So it is helpful to know the anatomy of the gastrointestinal tract using this upper GI study. Sometimes the radiologists are extra friendly and they're trying to tell us, oh, when you swallowed, we saw some reflux. And other times they'll say, oh, you swallowed, and then we never saw any reflux. But it's not a good test for reflux because it's only a moment in time, and the reflux can happen, the rest of the time. It just didn't happen that time, and therefore we didn't see it. Or the other way, that we saw a reflux, maybe the only time the child ever had a reflux. If we do want to test when reflux happens, the test is a pH probe. And since this has been in use for about 30 years or more, it has become very standardized test. Nowadays, the pH probe is called a pH impedance probe. It was designed by surgeons who were requiring children and adults to undergo surgery. They wanted to see which people had more reflux and should be the way to pick the appropriate candidates for surgery. So it's an excellent test for picking up reflux. The parameters we look at on this are exposure of the lower esophagus to the acid, how long it sits there, how long it takes to clear, are there long episodes, etc. So it gives us a very good episode related or quantity related evidence. It's also very useful to look at symptomatic correlation, because when reflux is happening, if we are experiencing symptoms at the same time, we could imply that the symptoms were related to reflux. And then there are sophisticated computerized modules. You can look at the association between the two, so symptom and the reflux episodes, and we can get a very good conclusion based on these parameters whether the symptom was caused by the reflux or not. There are ways of doing this wirelessly. Typically, these are reserved for older kids and adults. You can do an endoscopy, place this small, tiny probe in the lower esophagus, is attached to the wall of the esophagus, and can measure the reflux episodes for 2 to 3 days, or even up to 4 days. It's a very useful test for acid reflux. This particular wireless pH monitor, or Bravo, that's the trade name, is designed to look for long episodes of reflux, but it only tests pH, so it only looks for acid reflux. That's one of the limitations, because in children you may have reflux episodes, but they may not be acid related. So we have had some experience with this in the past. There are children who will experience some discomfort and may require it to be removed. That's one of the limitations. In adults, sometimes it can be performed without an endoscopy, but in children, it is almost always done with an endoscopy. And then the new thing that came up in the last 10 or 15 years was that we started looking at this value called impedance, which is if you have two electrodes that are shown in red here, and you pass an electric current, There is a conductivity between them, meaning the current will go from one electrode to the other. This conductivity will be very poor if there is air between the two electrodes, so the charges don't go. But if there is water there or liquid there, then quickly the electric current transmits. So the when it doesn't transmit, that's a high impedance. When it transmits quickly, the impedance drops. So this is helpful because then we can tell when the fluid entered this area and how long it stayed there and then it exited that area. And so you put a bunch of these probes from top to the bottom, you can see impedance dropped in this probe, then in this probe, then this probe, then sorry, this sensor, and then you can kind of say that was a swallow because the fluid started from the top and went down. On the other hand, if it starts in the reverse direction, then you can tell that that was a reflux episode. So pH impedance has sort of become the gold standard for pH monitoring these days. I don't believe anyone is doing pH only pH probes anymore. They're called multi-channel intraluminal because there typically will be 6 to 10 channels going from top to bottom. And like I said, you can tell when there is a bolus movement from top to bottom, that's a swallow, from bottom to up, that's a reflux. And typically, most of these impedance will have a one or two pH sensors in it. So we can also test when the reflux is happening, is it acid related or non-acid related? So this is what has helped us understand that a bunch of reflux episodes that happen are not acid reflux. And therefore, we were missing them when we were only looking for acid reflux with a pH probe. Also, because these are all computerized now, the sophistication of the software allows us to tell whether it is air or liquid, and liquid is more saliva or gastric refluxate, or from coming all the way down from the small bowel, the duodenal refluxate, based on the appearance of the impedance. So this is how a typical pH impedance study looks. There's a reflux episode happening from bottom to the top. The lowermost is the pH sensor. It tells us that the pH dropped, but it didn't go below 4, which is the cutoff for acid. So this is a typical episode for non-acid reflux episode. If the pH falls under 4, then that we call an acid reflux. You can see a reflux happening here, and the pH went below 4. So this is a very useful test. It can also tell us how long this stayed below 4. So here in this situation, maybe happened for 20, 30 seconds, 40 seconds. Oh, here it says 38. So it tells you the clearance of the lower esophagus when the reflux happened. The reflux episode wasn't too bad, but then it took almost 48 seconds, almost a minute to clear that. So a bunch of these episodes will be quite irritating to the lower esophagus. Similarly, if you'd combine it with a sleep study or with a polysomnography, you will see that the patient had obstructive sleep apnea right after having a reflux event. Then you can make that connection that with all the sleep disturbances the child was experiencing could be related to the reflux event. And you would have missed it because this pH remains over 4 if we just did a pH probe study. And then we can also look at the transit of the reflux. So the reflux comes up but kind of hangs around in the esophagus. We can have a true visual representation of the fluid, how long it sat in the esophagus. And that will tell us how much damage to expect in the esophagus from this. So those are called waveform volumetric analysis. So obviously pH impedance or pH MMI is a better, more detailed evaluation than a standard pH probe. If we want to look at the esophagus movement itself, then a better test is esophageal manometry. Now, if we look at swallow, when we chew our food and we push it down, we open our upper esophageal sphincter, then a wave of peristalsis kind of goes down until it reaches the lower sphincter, which then relaxes and lets the food go down. So the purpose of esophageal motility is move the food from top to bottom and prevent it from going backwards. So this can be seen in some X-ray tests. There's a test called scintigraphy, or where you put some liquid and you put some radionuclear material to it, and you can see how long it takes. It stays in the esophagus and then goes down into the stomach. And that way you can get some idea of the transit. You can also do this with a video of the swallow by adding some contrast, and that's called esophagogram, or an upper GI, modified upper GI study. There are other capsules, some of which are currently not available, but this smart pill is currently off market. But you can use those to assess the swallow as well. The esophageal scintigraphy, as I said before, you swallow and then you monitor this nuclear material going down into the stomach, and it gives you a curvature of the time it took and stayed there. So in conditions where there is poor clearance from the esophagus, this will tend to hang around for a long time in the esophagus. The gold standard of measuring the esophageal motility, however, is this test called esophageal manometry, which is performed by placing a probe through the nostril and measuring the pressure waves of the esophagus. So like I said before, that's how we measure how the esophagus is moving. One of the limitations you have to remember is this is measuring the esophageal motility. It's not telling us anything about the contents. All it is telling is whether the esophagus has peristalsis going from top to bottom, if the sphincters have normal pressure, if the sphincters are relaxing when they should be relaxing, and when they are contracting when they should be contracting. So it gives a very good sense of the function of the organ, but it doesn't tell you much about the transit. So you could potentially combine the two kinds of tests, like an X-ray test and a manometry test, to get a full assessment. The X-ray test, whether video test or scintigraphy, will help you figuring out the transit, and the manometry test can help you figure out the movement of the organ itself. So this is how an esophageal manometry looks: the pressure waves going down, lower esophageal sphincter relaxing, and you can measure how strong these contractions were, they were coordination or not, pressures of the sphincter, whether they were relaxing or not. And based on those, there are several conditions which we call dysmotility, where the motility is not intact. You may have biphasic pressure waves going back, lower esophageal sphincter not relaxing, etc. These conditions are often called achalasia, meaning a lack of peristalsis. Chalasia means movement, achalasia means lack of movement. So here you have a pressure wave that's not going down, and there's no relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter. Nowadays, we have multiple sensors in these probes, so they have become what we call high resolution. Each position has multiple sensors. So if you have 36 positions and each sensor has 12, then you can multiply 12 by 36, and you have that many informational points. And you have to put all that together, and it comes off as a color plot because it will be too many graphs to see from top to bottom. So this standard esophageal manometry becomes this high resolution esophageal manometry. You can see the colors here represent pressures. So higher pressures are hot, like yellow, orange, red. The lower pressures are blue, green, more cooler colors. So this is your upper esophageal sphincter. You have a swallow that initiates a trigger, sorry, triggers a contraction wave, a peristalsis that goes down the esophagus until reaches lower esophageal sphincter, which then relaxes, lets the food go down. So this is a normal esophageal swallow on a high resolution manometry. This is how it looks in real life. So you can see this is your constant pressure of upper esophageal sphincter, lower esophageal sphincter. A swallow triggers a peristalsis, nice, what we call a waterfall appearance, and then a relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter. If you compare or contrast that to other abnormal findings, you'll find that the lower esophageal sphincter is not opening. This is called EGJ obstruction, or there's a big pressure wave in the lower esophagus that's called distal or diffuse esophageal spasm, or you can see a lack of peristalsis, these strong columns happening. These are called achalasia. Based on these, you can have different kinds of achalasia. This is achalasia with what we call pan-esophageal pressurization, one pressure wave in the entire esophagus with non-relaxing lower esophageal sphincter. This is how a type 1 achalasia is when there is no peristalsis. You just see a swallow being initiated, but there is lack of peristalsis. You can also do various 3D maneuvers with it, and you can get what we call a contour plot to get a sense of how strong these achalasia contractions are. Moving down into the stomach and small intestine, you can do a similar thing here. Your stomachs are designed to be our storage organs, so the most of the storage happens here. But the top portion of the stomach is what we call accommodative. So when we fill our stomachs up with food, then we need some room for gas and et cetera. Then our fundus, the top portion, gets bigger to accommodate for the gas. And that's why we typically will eructate, or will pass the air out with a burp from the top rather than the bottom after eating. And then slowly, as the food is getting ready, it's passed on to the small intestine. So the stomach and proximal small intestine work as one unit called enteroduodenal unit. Typically, the activation happens somewhere here at the junction of top one-third to the lower two-thirds by a gastric pacemaker that then sends a signal down this portion of the stomach, which causes a relaxation of this sphincter here called pyloric sphincter, and passes the food to go down in the intestine in an intestinal peristalsis. If there is a disconnect between the two in several neurological conditions, then the stomach waves do not get transmitted down the intestines. Then we have what we call intestinal dysmotility, because intestines don't have a pacemaker of their own. This can also be studied with a simple test called gastric emptying study, where you eat a standardized meal and you see how long it stays in the stomach. As the name implies, it is measuring how long these contents stay in the stomach and how long it takes for it to empty. If you look at a standard gastric emptying curve, then in the beginning, it takes a slow approach and it may empty slowly, but in the end, it may go a little bit faster. So if you do a test only for the beginning of the study, then you may find that there are higher chances of finding slow activation or slow motility. So a standard test for gastric motility is gastric emptying study is 4 hours, because that's how much it might take for most individuals to empty their contents fully. More than 90% should empty in 4 hours, and that's the standard number to remember. If we have less than that, then we have a problem with gastric emptying. Gastric emptying is a useful test because it's an easy-to-do test in the sense that you just have to eat a meal and you go in the scanner every 10-15 minutes and you measure how much of it has emptied. The problem is lack of standardized techniques. So because a whole lot of adults get this study, most of the adult protocols are limited to 180 minutes or even 90 minutes. So if you do it only for the first hour and a half or 2 hours, several pediatric studies have shown that if they may show delayed gastric emptying at 2 hours, but if you continue to monitor that emptying by the end of 4th hour, their emptying may become normal. The factors that determine how long it takes for stomach contents to move could be related to multiple things: how much you eat, what's the acidity, what's the osmolarity, what's the protein content, what's the fat content, etc. But also other factors like your small bowel motility, your colonic distension, etc. So we have to remember gastric emptying is not just an isolated phenomenon. It is it indicates a whole bunch of things that will regulate how the stomach empties the contents. The gold standard again for measuring the motility of the stomach and small intestine will be a probe that we discussed similar to esophagus. This was called an enteroduodenal manometry because it measured the enterum part of the stomach and the duodenum part of the small intestine. It requires endoscopy for placement, and sometimes adults will perform it through interventional radiology. The placement requires some probes to be in the stomach and some probe to be in the intestine. In the old days, we were able to do this like in an ambulatory mode where you can attach to a recording device similar to pH probe. However, with the advent of high resolution, this is not feasible anymore. So in the past, it used to look like pressure waves like this, where activity started in the stomach and it will go down the intestines. However, as time has passed on, these are various phases of the activity. And then you can see abnormal activities in the stomach or small intestine where things may go backwards. But with high resolution, this has also changed. And therefore, we are not able to do this as an ambulatory test, but again, a similar test like esophageal, where you have to be attached to a computer. Further down in the colon and the anorectal, where we have our waste management, you can measure the colonic activity by a similar test. You do a colonoscopy and place a probe that measures the colonic activity. Colonic activity is stimulated by eating, so that's called postprandial or gastrocolonic response. As soon as you eat, your colon starts triggering these high pressure channels called HAPCs, high amplitude pressure contractions, and they are indicative of normal colonic activity. You can have experimentation. These are non-standardized clinical, non-clinical standardized tests that where you can do a Cine MRI study or MR measures of the colon and see how long it takes one portion of the colon to move the contents to the other side. You can also try to do the high resolution colonic manometry similar to what we had shown with the esophagus. And then finally, the very end of the GI tract, the anorectal muscles are very coordinated. However, here it's important to remember that we have some voluntary control and some involuntary control. So if we want to measure the anorectal function, we require both the voluntary and the involuntary actions to be assessed. And therefore, if the individual is not able to be cooperative and follow directions, then these tests are difficult to perform. When you place the probes in the anorectal muscles, again, you're putting probe backwards here. You have a small balloon in the rectum, and then the pressure sensors are in the anal canal. Very similar to the esophageal high resolution, the pressures are high when they are yellow, red, and purple. The pressures are low when they are green and blue. So this is our anal sphincters. This is the rectum, which is kind of open and big. And then as the pressure waves triggered by the activation by a balloon, you will see a peristalsis and a relaxation of the anal sphincters. And you can measure these in a couple of ways. You can ask the individual to push, like they're trying to get the poop out, and that way the sphincter should relax. So we should see a relaxation of the sphincter. You can ask them to squeeze, and you should see an increase in the sphincter pressure. Smart pill is currently off market, so this is was an innovative product where you would swallow and it measures the pH, temperature, pressure as it goes through. So you can see how long it stayed in the esophagus, how long it was in the stomach, in the small bowel, and the large intestine. However, because of manufacturing issues, it's currently not being produced in the US. So once you have done all these tests and you have figured out what the problem could be in relation to the gut motility. How do we approach these conditions? And I usually tell people it takes a village in these conditions because they're not, this is not like saying I have a, it's almost like saying I have a heart disease, and then heart disease could be anything in the heart. So if somebody says I have a gut dysmotility, that could be anywhere. It could be in your upper GI tract, lower GI tract. It could be isolated. It could involve the entire GI tract. It could predominantly be just at the very outlet. So the approaches are individualized based on what the person is experiencing. A typical way to divide these would be to think of them as diet-related changes, medications, behavior modifications, and then some cases, surgical approaches. So, in terms of dietary modification, the basic principles are here. I understand you guys are going to hear from a professional nutritionist on how to approach diet. The general idea is that smaller and more frequent meals are better, liquids are better tolerated, low protein, I'm sorry, low fat. Higher protein and low fiber are better tolerated. Again, all that goes in with how things move in the GI tract. The idea is to make sure that we don't run into hyperglycemia or hypoglycemia, which is sort of important despite us not being diabetic, because when we go into hyperglycemia, our intestines slow down. When we have a hypoglycemia, that triggers an insulin response. Because we have hypoglycemia to slow down the insulin response, meaning the insulin level might be the same, but our body will not want to respond to it. So the glycemic response or insulin response. So the idea is to make sure as long as possible to maintain glucose between 70 and 140. And these days there are several devices that help us do that with continuous glucose monitoring. Episodes of hypoglycemia, episodes of hyperglycemia will further make the motility variable. There are medications that can be used, say, for example, prokinetics or promotility agents such as saccharide, betaine, erythromycin. They are there, they are very limited in use. Sisupride is no longer available, but its cousin is called prucalopride or motegridi. It's being widely used among adults. In pediatrics, it's not so much because it's not been tested on kids a lot. However, that doesn't mean it doesn't work. It just has not been tried and tested in kids. Bethanecol is primarily used by pulmonary physicians because it also causes a little bit of respiratory secretion changes. So most of the gastroenterologists are hesitant, but in certain conditions we use it predominantly. Erythromycin is an antibiotic. One of its side effects is to move the intestines along. So if you really have very poor stomach or small intestinal activity, you could consider using erythromycin and a couple of its cousins called Augmentin or azithromycin can also be used in a similar way. Domperidone sounds like an alcohol, but really is a medication that promotes activity in the stomach and small intestine. It's not available in the US. It's considered as an orphan drug that you can get it from Canada or Mexico. The problem with domperidone is it's been in use for decades in the Europe and other continents in the world. It has not been really tested a lot in the US, and there is very limited market for it. So no pharmaceutical company wants to get into it. Metoclopramide or Reglan is a useful medication. However, the problem with metoclopramide is its side effects, so it's really not used a lot in pediatrics. And then this is chloride transport channel. I'm sorry, the picture became fuzzy here for I'm not sure why, but this is how the chloride channels activate the absorption of water in our GI tract, especially in the colon. This is affected in children with cystic fibrosis, for example, and this is why they have thick secretions. This principle was used for these medications. Those are called chloride channel activators. So if you activate the chloride channels, you will not absorb as much water, and therefore the poop will remain soft. So these group of medications called chloride channel activators, including lubiprostone, can be used to activate the chloride channels and make the stool soft. There are a couple of new medications in this group that are in process of being used in children. Linaclotide is one of them, which is currently trialed in pediatrics as a chloride channel activator. Endoscopic procedures are sometimes utilized. This is a procedure called pneumatic dilatation, or balloon dilatation, where you pass a channel through the camera and you open up the sphincter muscles. This is predominantly used for conditions like achalasia, where there's a lack of peristalsis and lack of sphincter opening. So you can do a dilatation of that area that allows the food to go down. You can do this pneumatic dilatation of the sphincter muscles in the pylorus or the stomach, and also you can do some dilation of the anorectal sphincters. You can also inject some Botox to these muscles so that they are a little bit more compliant. You can make them work a little bit or relax a little bit better by using Botox. And if needed, you can also surgically relax these sphincters with a myotomy procedure. Okay. I think it's best to stop at this point and take any questions, and I will see how I can help with that.
We have a lot of wonderful questions coming through, so I'm just going to go ahead and start tackling them. One patient asked, "Can you speak on the medical keto diet's impact on GI motility? Also, my daughter has a G-tube for Hurley syndrome. How does a G-tube affect the process of digestion if almost no food is taken by mouth?"
Yeah, excellent questions. Keto diet predominantly is fat dependent. So the way you make more ketones in our body is that to increase the fat contents in your diet. And when we don't process all the fat, that fat is converted into ketones. If you have poor motility, a keto diet will make it difficult to move through because it will be making things slow. Like I showed you, the higher fat content diets will move slowly through your GI tract. So in individuals, if there is slow motility, then higher fat content diets will have difficulty moving along. In terms of G-tube, the G-tube itself is just a conduit to delivering the fluid. So it's almost just like you're drinking fluid through the mouth, and or you put it food directly into the stomach. Now, it's very interesting that over time, when we have surgeons placing the gastrostomy tubes, they have placed it in the stomach in the upper portion because it is easy to approach surgically. But the gastric pacemaker lives very close to the area where the surgeons place the gastrostomy tubes. So we as gastroenterologists sometimes will see children who had G-tube placement and have issues with tolerating the feeds after that. But in majority of the instances, it is not related to the placement of the G-tube itself. It might be more indicative of like the underlying condition that was making that led to the placement of G-tube. But it has to be investigated in some children.
Have you had patients before that have to be like might have patients that have to be on the ketogenic diet due to seizures and but are struggling with gut motility? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, most of the time, if we are having, say, for example, there is a need, the person has to be on a keto diet, but having trouble tolerating the tube feeds in the stomach, even if they are given by a G-tube. the best solution for those kind of situation is to pass the stomach, because the stomach was designed as a storage organ. And when we eat, nature did not intend us to be eating all the time. Now, I do it all the time, like I eat all the time, but that wasn't the purpose of our bodies. Our body were designed to eat, store our food in the stomach for 3 or 4 hours, empty it slowly into the intestine over those 3 to 4 hours. So the intestines can only digest and absorb in slow batches, right? So it cannot process if we put entire food at one time. So if we mimic that, so if we are delivering nutrition into someone's stomach, there's no necessity to put it every 3 hours. Now, obviously, it is more convenient for us, but if we change that tube into what we call GJ tubes or transpyloric tubes, and we pass the tube from stomach into the intestines directly, the limitation would be you cannot feed a big bolus of food, right? Because you cannot store the food any longer. But you could slowly trickle that food, and the intestines should clearly be able to tolerate that as long as we give it slowly. But it becomes a cumbersome thing for the families because it has to be running for long periods of time.
Another patient asked, she said, I'm a parent of an individual with Barth syndrome. Is there a relationship between gut microbiomes and rare diseases, especially those with compromised immune systems?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think more and more understanding is developing on the interaction of microbiomes. Anytime we don't move our intestinal secretions proximally, we will make the conditions predisposing for bacterial overgrowth. So you have to understand what I'm trying to say here. It is not that the poor motility leads to bacterial overgrowth, but we get rid of the intestinal microbiome. We get rid of the bad bacteria by purging it, by moving it along. So if we are not able to move them well, the bacteria will sit in the stomach. In that situation, if we have more food coming down, then the bacteria enjoy that and they multiply, right? If we were in a closed environment, people experienced this during epidemics, etc. You know, they were in closed environments, they were having fun inside, they were eating, drinking, and having more babies, you know, so or getting more pets. So that's what the bacteria do. So if we are not purging these bacteria out, then they're kind of staying in this stasis environment, and then they multiply. So by moving things along, we are able to get rid of the bacteria. Therefore, poor motility will predispose you to bacterial overgrowth. That doesn't mean that bacterial overgrowth led to poor dysmotility or poor motility. It's just is the right environment for the bacteria to grow.
Another patient asked, with bile reflux in mito patients, is it caused by neuropathy or is it more a consequence of gastroparesis and weak muscles in mito patients altogether?
Yeah, that's also an excellent question. Yeah, I think these are very smart questions. So I think both of those have to be considered, whether it is just because we are making a lot of acid and acid is going back, or if we have relaxed sphincters that is allowing more gastric contents to come back up, or it is because the stomach contents don't empty down further into the intestines and therefore they are regurgitating back. So any of those conditions will cause more of the gastric contents to come backwards, and that will be gastroesophageal reflux.
And another patient asked, at what point does a GI motility presentation suggest an underlying metabolic or mitochondrial disorder that needs to be deeper evaluated? How do you approach that?
Yeah, that's also an excellent question. This is the usual thing I try to tell my trainees, that when we are looking at a condition, we're looking at an individual. You know, we are gastroenterologists, and then you see a cardiologist, and then you see a neurologist. But the body is the body, right? The person is a person. And then it's not just the body, and then there's also body and the mind, right? So how we perceive things, how the sensory organs are working, was the pain related to it, was the nausea related to it? And then the third part of this is the intellect. Like, how do we understand what our body and mind are trying to tell us, right? So that goes back to how we think, how we understand things, so how intellectual we are in understanding these things. So I always tell my trainees that bodies are strong, but mind is stronger than the body, and intellect is stronger than the mind. Now, artificially, we have made this whole medicine, understanding of medicine, into a condition of body where we study only the GI tract, or only the cardiovascular system, or only the endocrine system. But that's primarily so that we have expertise in these areas. But we cannot forget the whole person, right? So when we are taking care of, when we are providing service to individuals, we are providing service to the whole person. And so we have to look at all those situations. So if we have individuals where it is clear that this is not just the GI tract, maybe it's also showing evidence that there's respiratory involvement or neurologic involvement or developmental or intellectual involvement or sensory perception. So then we have to approach it like that. So sorry for the long answer, but the idea is that we have to sometimes keep our minds open that some of this presentation could be related to a more systemic condition and not just to the GI tract.
The next question kind of goes along those lines because you have mitochondrial disease, right? That may or may not be able to be genetically confirmed at this point. The genetics is getting better and better, but there's still mitochondrial disease that isn't able to be confirmed with genetics. Then you also have complications of mitochondrial dysfunction, right? Which is a little bit different. And then you have the whole other gamut of metabolic conditions. And so what this patient is asking is in children with feeding intolerance, how do you distinguish between GI motility disorders and underlying metabolic or mitochondrial dysfunction? Like how do you, like as a clinician, how do you maybe categorize these things to try to figure out, okay, like this is like the basis of what we think is going on. Understand sometimes you're working out of hypothesis, right?
No, I think that's excellent. So we're really looking for clues, because metabolic conditions will not just affect the GI tract. So if we see some evidence that maybe it is affecting the endocrine system also, or neurologic system, or developmental issues, then kind of gives us a clue that this is more related. Or if we see generalized neurological involvement in addition to the gut neuro, my colleagues often joke with me that I am more a neurologist than a gastroenterologist because I do the neurology of the GI tract, right? So they don't think I am a gastroenterologist because I'm always talking about how the gut is moving, and it's served by these nerves, and it works only when the muscles work. And so they don't think I look at the gut as gut. I look at the gut as a neurologic organ, which is really, if you go to the root of it, the gut is a very highly sophisticated neurologic organ. It would not work if your nerves and muscles are not working. So obviously, if there is a clue that the nerve and muscles of the entire body are affected, then it behooves us to look at the entire body as like a metabolic condition rather than thinking this is primarily just a GI condition.
Can you dig a little bit deeper into that in regards to how the nerves and the muscles like affect the gut? So if you have, yeah.
To be like, if we, so we have studies where people have taken out all the neurons in the GI tract. So you can imply that. You can take portions and do some counts and do the math. If I took out all the nerves of the GI tract and counted them, the number of neurons in the GI tract is going to be higher than the number of neurons in the spinal cord. Now, if I told you a spinal cord is a neurologic organ, nobody would question that. But if I told you that gut is a neurologic organ, people would laugh, right? Because people think gut is a digestive organ. The reason is because the function of the GI tract is to digest and absorb. So we have never thought of how the gut really works. But the other way of looking at it is that when we eat, so we start with a voluntary process. We decide what to eat and we put it in our mouths and we chew it. And we chew it because so that it becomes ready for digestion and absorption. Because if you put the intact things, you won't be digesting it. So we chew it and we make it into this mush, which we then push down, right? Once we push it down from the mouth down into the oropharynx, we really have no control over it, right? From here on, your body is going to take care of it. So, how is the body going to take care of this thing that you voluntarily put down, right? So, it requires very profound sensory and motor mechanisms for it to happen. And it knows exactly what you ate. So, the day you go to Cheesecake Factory versus the day you eat a salad, your body is going to know the difference. That today a big meal is coming down, which is high in fat content, very highly osmolar, low in fluid. And so it's going to act differently that day versus the day that you eat salad, where there's going to be a lot of fiber, a lot of fluid that will help things move along faster. So your GI tract has to have excellent sensors to perceive that, right? Starting from the esophagus down. So it knows how this is going down, how long it should stay in the stomach. So if you eat bigger chunk particles versus smaller chunk particles, that stomach has to grind them more. So those bigger particles are going to stay longer in the stomach. So that day, your stomach emptying will be slower because your stomach is going to grind and grind before it passes it down the intestine. And also, it knows how much of one content is there versus the other. So, if you combine fat and protein, and fat, protein, and sugar, the emptying of the stomach is going to be very different because the sugar goes down very quickly. It doesn't need any grinding, it doesn't need any preparation for it. So, it just goes down very quickly. So if you have a very high sugar content, you will quickly have that pass through in the intestines. Your sugar levels will rise very fast because you don't need a lot of digestion absorption for simple sugars. They get absorbed very quickly. And hyperglycemia will further slow down your motility. So, say, for example, you did very well and you had very good proportion of protein in your diet and you had a little bit higher fat that day. But if you added a bunch of sugar to it, that day your motility is going to be even slower than if you did not have the sugar, because that sugar went down, caused hyperglycemia, and further reduced your ability to move things along. So your sensory mechanisms are critical because they sense what you took today. But how that is implemented happens with the muscles. So the nerves will then signal the muscles and say, hey, pyloric sphincter, get a little bit tighter. We don't want more food going down. Hey, small intestines, move slowly because we don't want to absorb all this as fast because your sugar levels are already rising pretty fast. So after a big meal, we all experience this, right? Again, Cheesecake Factory, I have nothing against it. I'm sorry, I've never gone there, but I use that example just for the name Cheesecake Factory, right? It's so enticing to use that name. But if you have a big meal anywhere, right? And then you have very high amount of food, and then it is loaded with sugars in the end, then that we experience that distension, we experience that discomfort, and we feel that somnolence. We feel like we should just go down and sleep, right? We experience all that because that your time, your body has perceived that there is a big meal. This is going to take a long time to process, and it's going to be slowing down your intestinal activity. So you feel that distension, you feel that things are moving really slow until that whole meal passes through you and then becomes a waste. Then you experience that. So in order for all this to happen, your nerves are doing tremendous amount of sensory and motor work, right? So especially in conditions with where the battery runs out fast, that's the best acronym I can say for Mido, right? So you have a limited lower amounts of batteries, but they also run out pretty fast. If you make it work fast, then you would experience these things, right? So by regulating what you take and by making sure things are moving along well, you have a better chance of not causing this dysregulation.
So the neurons in the gut, when they are not functioning properly, I mean, I think general neuropathy, often when the neurons are not functioning properly, there's no way to re regain that. Like, is it the same with the gut, or like, are the neurons in the gut a little bit different, and how if they're not functioning the same?
I do think you can train your neurons some. Say for example, the distensibility can be adjusted. So when I see children who have a lot of chronic constipation problems and their colons get really distended or dilated, especially at the very end when the rectum is big, I always talk to the families that it's really important to keep that rectum empty. Because if we keep that rectum full, the further we distend that rectum, it puts more pressure on that rectum to function. You're right? So if you have say, an elastic bag, now a shopping bag is too thin, but in the old days, we used to have soccer footballs, which had a bladder inside, and you fill it with air, right? So those, when you fill, they as they become big and big, they are not as distensible anymore, right? Because you really stretch them out, so the contractile activity gets worse and worse if you distend it more. So if we keep that rectum shrunk, if we keep that rectum empty and not dilated, then we have a better chance of that rectum working than if we fill it up and make it big and dilated. Does that make sense? So if we create these situations where we are pressurizing the muscles and the nerves to do more, then they are going to function poorly. Then, if we provide them the best environment and say, look, we're going to give you a good environment, we're not going to be as distended, and we're not going to leave you as full, then you would work better.
I know we're getting close to time, but we have such amazing questions. If you have a couple more minutes, I'd like to ask
Yeah,
a couple more.
sure.
Another patient asked if you can explain why Mito affects the GI system. Is it affecting the entronic nervous system or the smooth muscle system or both?
Yeah, no, I think so. The enteric nervous system is made of the smooth muscles, the nerves that supply the nervous supply is predominantly through our autonomic nervous system, which has both sympathetic and parasympathetic. So, again, I think it is more global effect of the mito, because the mitochondria are so global, right? So they are everywhere. They're in every cell, or most of the cells, or 99.9% of the cells. And any cells that require high energy work, you need higher concentration of mitochondria in that situation. So if we have if we have mitochondrial conditions, then obviously those cells are further challenged because they have to work extra hard.
This might go along with that a little bit. This patient says that they have LCHAD and have noticed that when they're in rhabdo, that they struggle to swallow and have bowel movements. They struggle to swallow and have bowel movements, even with their GI meds. They were wondering if you could explain why, in times of metabolic crisis, motility shuts down. I'm assuming it's due to lack of energy and muscle damage. Is that correct? That's what she asked.
No, I think that would be a simple way of thinking about it, because all the whatever we had reserve was caused to be damaged by the rhabdomyosin. Lysis is just bad, right? So it's destroying the muscles. So yeah, I would suggest that would be.
Another patient, so I'm going to kind of go to a different form of motility because you talked about the diarrhea component. And this patient asked about when you're experiencing sudden onsets of a diarrhea episode with no control, most often immediately after ingesting food, not related to stomach illness, is there understanding what comes out? Like what could be going on? Because there's this understanding that that what you just put in your body, there's no way it can be moving out immediately. But how does that work when that happens?
That's a good question. I mean, the gastrocolonic we talked about, so as soon as we put something in the stomach, it will trigger a colonic activity. So the gastrocolonic response is pretty immediate. When we put these probes to measure the stomach and intestinal activity, we'll see them within 10 minutes, 5 minutes, like very, very quick. So you put food in the stomach, and then it quickly triggers a colonic activity. Typically, what people experience in these conditions, the best way to think of it is like IBS. So IBS is irritable bowel syndrome, where we say the bowel is irritated because it reacts very quickly. Like when you're angry, when you're not in a good mood, somebody comes and just says something which you might have otherwise tolerated, then you snap back and you say bad things right away, right? So I think that's why the acronym IBS has come, because we think that the bowel is just irritated, and anytime we do something, it triggers a reaction, right? So I think otherwise, I have no good explanation why they call it IBS. So in situations like this, there is exaggerated gastrocolonic response, but in some individuals, there could be a very rapid transit. And studies have shown that whatever you had just eaten could be coming out in 15, 20 minutes if you had a very quick small bowel transit. So, in individuals who have IBS with diarrhea, sometimes we'll have very rapid intestinal transit times. So they ate and they didn't realize it was 15 minutes while they were eating, but the stomach contents really went very quickly through. And then the eating triggered a gastrocolonic response. And then they passed whatever was there from before, but also included things that they had just eaten. So many times parents will tell me that no, it cannot be the yesterday's food that came out, because we saw things that the child had just eaten, maybe in half an hour back or something. And yes, so it tells us that the small bowel transit was really very rapid. It just went through very quickly. And that doesn't mean we are not digesting or absorbing, because most people who have IBS do not end up having poor digestion or poor nutrition. Their bodies are totally fine. They absorb whatever they need to absorb. They just have very rapid transit.
Another question is, there's so many different great questions in here. Let me see. It's hard to choose. I want everybody to know that's written these amazing questions, that you have done such an amazing job. And so I just, and I will try to note the questions later, and maybe we can ask Dr. Dabari to come in and just do a Q&A time so we can finish up some of these questions.
Sure. Let's find time for that.
Could you comment on the mechanism of GI dysmotility and poor feeding in patients with Barth syndrome and other mitochondrial disorders?
I think it's going to be too specific. We would have to look at like each symptom. And I like that's why I gave the overview. It is because it could very well be a generalized condition for all those, but it could be that we can use guidance from our symptoms as to figuring out which part is more affected.
Do you know if ondansetron slows gastric motility?
So ondansetron, right? Ondansetron is an antiemetic medication. So it's designed to change the trigger the sensation against nausea. So this is the typical anti-nausea medication. It doesn't have a lot of effect on the GI tract itself. It is just changing the perception. So when the signals come, you will have less nausea as a result.
Do you agree with research claiming that 60% of IBS is SIBO? I don't know what SIBO means, but.
Yeah, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I am not sure we can put a high percent like that. But I'm not sure what specifically they are saying. Clearly, people who have IBS will have a higher chance of having bacterial overgrowth. However, there are people who will have pretty significant IBS and not have bacterial overgrowth. So to think that, because IBS is a very common condition. So 1 in 5 is what a number I typically tell people. So 20 to 25% of population has IBS. But IBS also is a very diverse condition. So you can have IBS and you can have diarrhea, and you can have IBS and you can have constipation. And then you can have anything in between. So the motility in people with IBS is going to be very different than motility in people with IBS with constipation. So I think when we are talking about IBS, we have a mixed bag. We have a big bag and we have a mixed bag. So I'm not sure if we can say 60%.
Okay, last question. And then, know everyone, I'm going to take pictures of all of your questions, and hopefully we can circle back around to some of them in the future. In the context of mito, can you talk about how dysmotility can fluctuate and your understanding as to why that may occur?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, first of all, even in mito, if you don't have poor motility, you will see fluctuation in just the functioning of the rest of the neuromuscular functions, right? So some days your skeletal muscles will function better than the other days, right? And that's the nature of the supply of the energy, the supply of the power charge you're getting from the mito. However, if you have a dysmotility, you still have a very limited amount of power supply you are getting in mito. And so if there is a day where all the energy is going towards neuromuscular problems or cardiovascular problems or respiratory problems, you could totally think that it may have less supply to go to your gut motility because it was trying to figure out too many energy sources. So, absolutely, it will affect our motility up and down in a day-to-day condition, but also a day-to-day condition with variance in usage of this energy for other supplies. Right? Because your energy supply is that limited. So it has to be diverted, based on the demand.
I think that's super helpful because I think that's one of the things that we circle back to often as patients. It's the mito doesn't look the same today as it will tomorrow, as it will 3 weeks from now. And then you might have a doctor's appointment for a particular reason, and the reason why you're there doesn't match the reason why you called 3 weeks ago. And trying to explain that can be really hard as a parent or as a patient. So it's very validating to hear a little bit why that is. So thank you for walking us through that. And thank you so much for taking the time today and explaining so much to us about gut motility issues. And we really appreciate all of your hard work, your kind spirit, and your willingness just to share your knowledge with us. And if you're joining us today, no, and your questions weren't answered, I am going to take pictures of these questions to make sure we can try to circle back around to some of them. And I'll put my email in the chat as well, if you need to reach out. But thanks again, Dr. Dabari, for all of your work and everything that you do. And we look forward to hopefully seeing you sometime in the near future.
Absolutely. I'm so delighted to be here, and thank you so much for taking the time to listen to me and to my interest in gut motility. Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful day.